This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Joy Chan. Mysticism, A Study in Nature and Development of Spiritual Consciousness by Evelyn Underhill. First half of Part 2, Chapter 4, The Illumination of the Self. In illumination, we come to that state of consciousness which is popularly supposed to be peculiar to the mystic, a form of mental life, a kind of perception radically different from that of normal men. His preceding adventures and experiences cannot be allowed this quality. His awakening to consciousness of the Absolute, though often marked by a splendour and intensity which seem to distinguish it from other psychic upheavals of that kind, does but reproduce upon higher levels those characteristic processes of conversion and falling in love, which give depth and actuality to the religious and passional life. The purification to which he then sets himself, though this possesses as a rule certain features peculiar to mystical development, is again closely related to the disciplines and mortifications of ascetic, but not necessarily mystical, piety. It is the most exalted form with which we are acquainted of that catharsis, that pruning and training of the human plant, which is the essence of all education, and a necessary stage in every kind of transcendence. Here the mystic does but adopt in a more drastic form the principles which all who would live with an intense life, all seekers after freedom, all true lovers, must accept, though he may justly claim with Ophelia that these wear their rue with a difference. But in the great swing back into sunshine, which is the reward of that painful descent into the cell of self-knowledge, he parts company with these other pilgrims. Those who still go with him a little way, certain prophets, poets, artists, dreamers, do so in virtue of that mystical genius, that instinct for transcendental reality, of which all seers and creators have some trace. The initiates of beauty or of wisdom, as the great mystic is the initiate of love, they share in some degree the experiences of the way of illumination. But the mystic has now a veritable foothold in that transcendental world into which they penetrate now and again, enjoys a certain fellowship, not yet union, with the great life of the all, and thence draws strength and peace. Really and actually, as one whose novitiate is finished, he has entered the inner choir, where the soul joineth hands and danceth with Sophia, the divine wisdom, and, keeping time with the great rhythms of the spiritual universe, feels that he has found his place. This change of consciousness, however abrupt and amazing it may seem to the self which experiences it, seems to the psychologist a normal phase in that organic process of development which was initiated by the awakening of the transcendental sense, responding to the intimations received in that awakening, ordering itself in their interests, concentrating its scattered energies on this one thing. The self emerges from long and varied acts of purification to find that it is able to apprehend another order of reality. It has achieved consciousness of a world that was always there, and wherein its substantial being, that ground which is of God, has always stood. Such a consciousness is transcendental feeling in excelsis, a deep intuitional knowledge of the secret plan. "We are like a choir who stand round the conductor," says Plotinus, "but do not always sing in tune, because their attention is diverted by looking at external things. So we always move round the one. If we did not, we should dissolve and cease to exist. But we do not always look towards the one. Hence, instead of that free and conscious cooperation in the great life of the all, which alone can make personal life worth living, we move like slaves or marionettes, and, oblivious of the whole to which our little steps contribute, fail to observe the measure whereto the world keeps time. Our minds, being distracted from the Corypheus in the midst of the energetic word who sets the rhythm, we do not behold him. We are absorbed in the illusions of sense. The eye which looks on eternity is idle. But when we do behold him," says Plotinus again, "we attain the end of our existence and our rest. Then we no longer sing out of tune, but form a truly divine chorus about him, in the which chorus dance the soul beholds the fountain of life, the fountain of intellect, the principle of being, the cause of good, the root of soul. such a beholding, such a lifting of consciousness from self-centered to a God-centered world is of the essence of illumination. It will be observed that in these passages the claim of the mystic is not yet to supreme communion, the spiritual marriage of the Christian mystic, or that flight of the alone to the alone, which is the Platonian image for the utmost bliss of the emancipated soul. He has now got through preliminaries, detached himself from his chief entanglements, reoriented his instinctive life. The result is a new and solid certitude about God and his own soul's relation to God, an enlightenment in which he is adjusted to new standards of conduct and thought. In the traditional language of asceticism, he is proficient but not yet perfect. He achieves a real vision and knowledge, a conscious harmony with the divine world of becoming, not yet self-lost in the principle of life, but rather a willing and harmonious revolution about him, that in dancing he may know what is done. This character distinguishes almost every first-hand description of illumination, and it is this which marks it off from mystic union in all its forms. All pleasurable and exalted states of mystic consciousness in which the sense of I-hood persists, in which there is a loving and joyous relation between the absolute as object and the self as subject, fall under the head of illumination, which is really an enormous development of the intuitional life at high levels. All veritable and first-hand apprehensions of the divine obtained by the use of symbols, as in the religious life, all the degrees of prayer lying between meditation and the prayer of union, many phases of poetic inspiration and glimpses of truth, are activities of the illuminated mind. To see God in nature, to attain a radiant consciousness of the otherness of natural things, is the simplest and commonest form of illumination. Most people, under the spell of emotion or of beauty, have known flashes of rudimentary vision of this kind. Where such a consciousness is recurrent, as it is in many poets, there results that partial yet often overpowering apprehension of the infinite life imminent in all things, which some modern writers have dignified by the name of nature mysticism. Where it is raised to its highest denomination, till the veil is obliterated by the light behind, and faith has vanished into sight, as sometimes happened to Blake, we reach the point at which the mystic swallows up the poet. "Dear sir," says the great genius in one of his most characteristic letters, written immediately after an onset of the illuminated vision which he had lost for many years, "excuse my enthusiasm, or rather madness, for I am really drunk with intellectual vision whenever I take a pencil or graver into my hand." Many a great painter, philosopher, or poet, perhaps every inspired musician, has known this indescribable inebriation of reality in those moments of transcendence in which his masterpieces were conceived. This is the saving madness of which Plato speaks in the Phaedrus, the ecstasy of the God-intoxicated man, the lover, the prophet, and the poet drunk with life. When the Christian mystic, eager for his birthright, says, "Sangrius Christi, inebria me," he is asking for just such a gift of supernal vitality, a draught of that wine of absolute life which runs in the arteries of the world. Those to whom that cup is given attain to an intenser degree of vitality, hence to a more acute degree of perception, a more vivid consciousness than that which is enjoyed by other men. For though, as Ruysbroeck warns us, this is not God, yet it is for many selves the light in which we see him. Blake conceived that it was his vocation to bring this mystical illumination, this heightened vision of reality, within the range of ordinary men, to cleanse the doors of perception of the race. They thought him a madman for his pains. "I rest not upon my great task to open the eternal worlds, to open the immortal eyes of man inwards into the worlds of thought, into eternity ever expanding in the bosom of God, the human imagination. O Saviour, pour upon me thy spirit of meekness and love, annihilate the selfhood in me, be thou all my life." The mysteries of the antique world appear to have been attempts, often by way of a merely magical initiation, to open the immortal eyes of man inwards, exalt his powers of perception until they could receive the messages of a higher degree of reality. In spite of much eager theorizing, it is impossible to tell how far they succeeded in this task. To those who had a natural genius for the infinite, symbols and rituals which were doubtless charged with ecstatic suggestions, and often dramatized the actual course of the mystic way, may well have brought some enhancement of consciousness, though hardly that complete rearrangement of character which is an essential of the mystic's entrance on the true illuminated state. Hence Plato only claims that he whose initiation is recent can see immortal beauty under mortal veils. O blessed he and all-wise, who hath drunk the living fountain, whose life no folly staineth, and whose soul is near to God, whose sins are lifted poor-wise, as he worships on the mountain. Thus sang the initiates of Dionysus, that mystery cult in which the Greeks seemed to have expressed all they knew of the possible movement of consciousness through rites of purification to the ecstasy of the illuminated life. The mere crude rapture of illumination has seldom been more vividly expressed. With its half-oriental fervours, its self-regarding glory and personal purification achieved, and the spiritual superiority conferred by adeptship, may be compared to the deeper and lovelier experience of the Catholic poet and saint, who represents the spirit of Western mysticism at its best. His sins, too, have been lifted poor-wise, as a cloud melts in the sunshine of divine love. But here the centre of interest is not the little self which has been exalted, but the greater self which deigns thus to exalt. O burn that burns to heal! O more than pleasant wound! O soft hand, O touch most delicate, that dost new life reveal, that dost in grace abound, and slaying dost from death to life translate. Here the joy is as passionate, the consciousness of an exalted life as intense, but it is dominated by the distinctive Christian concepts of humility, surrender, and intimate love. We have seen that all real artists, as well as all pure mystics, are sharers to some degree in the illuminated life. They have drunk with Blake from that cup of intellectual vision which is the chalice of the spirit of life, know something of its divine inebriation whenever beauty inspires them to create. Some have only sipped it. Some, like John of Parma, have drunk deep, accepting in that act the mystic heritage with all its obligations. But to all who have seen beauty face to face, the grail has been administered, and through that sacramental communion they are made participants in the mystery of the world. In one of the most beautiful passages of the Fioretti, it is told how Brother Jacques of La Massa, unto whom God opened the door of his secrets, saw in a vision this chalice of the spirit of life, delivered by Christ into the hands of St. Francis, that he might give his brothers to drink thereof. Then came St. Francis to give the chalice of life to his brothers, and he gave it first to Brother John of Parma, who, taking it, drank it all in haste devoutly. And straightway he became all shining like the sun. And after him St. Francis gave it to all the other brothers in order, and there were but few among them that took it with due reverence and devotion, and drank it all. Those that took it devoutly and drank it all became straightway shining like the sun. But those that spilled it all and took it not devoutly became black and dark and mishapen and horrible to see. But those that drank part and spilled part became partly shining and partly dark, and more so or less according to the measure of their drinking or spilling thereof. But the aforesaid Brother John was resplendent above all the rest, the which had more completely drunk the chalice of life, whereby he had the more deeply gazed into the abyss of the infinite light divine. No image, perhaps, could suggest so accurately as this divine picture the conditions of perfect illumination. The drinking deeply, devoutly, and in haste, that is, without prudent and self-regarding hesitation, of the heavenly wine of life, that wine of which Rolle says that it fulfills the soul with a great gladness through a sweet contemplation. John of Parma, the hero of those spiritual Franciscans in whose interest this exquisite allegory was composed, stands for all the mystics who, having completely drunk, have attained the power of gazing into the abyss of the infinite light divine. In those imperfect brothers who dared not drink the cup of sacrifice to the dregs, but took part and spilled part, so that they became partly shining and partly dark, according to the measure of their drinking or spilling thereof, we may see an image of the artist, musician, prophet, poet, dreamer, more or less illuminated according to the measure of courage and self-abandonment in which he has drunk the cup of ecstasy. But always in comparison with the radiance of the pure contemplative, partly shining and partly dark. "Hinder me not," says the soul to the senses in Mechtild of Magdeburg's vision. "I would drink for a space of the unmingled wine." In the artist, the senses have somewhat hindered the perfect inebriation of the soul. We have seen that a vast tract of experience, or the experience which results from contact between a purged and heightened consciousness and the world of becoming in which it is immersed, and much too of that which results from contact set up between such a consciousness and the absolute itself, is included in that stage of growth which the mystics call the illuminative way. This is the largest and most densely populated province of the mystic kingdom. Such different visionaries as Suso and Blake, Boehm and Angelo Foligno, Mechtild of Magdeburg, Fox, Roll, St. Teresa, and countless others have left us the record of their sojourn therein. Amongst those who cannot be called pure mystics, we can detect in the works of Plato and Heraclitus, Wordsworth, Tennyson, and Walt Whitman, indications that they too were acquainted, beyond most poets and seers, with the phenomena of the illuminated life. In studying it, then, we shall be confronted by a mass of apparently irreconcilable material, the results of the relation set up between every degree of lucidity, every kind of character, and the suprasensible world. To say that God is infinite is to say that he may be apprehended and described in an infinity of ways. That circle whose centre is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere may be approached from every angle with a certainty of being found. Mystical history, particularly that which deals with the illuminative way, is a demonstration of this fact. Here in the establishment of the first mystic life, of conscious correspondence with reality, the self which has oscillated between two forms of consciousness has alternately opposed and embraced its growing intuitions of the absolute, comes for a time to rest. To a large extent, the discordant elements of character have been purged away. Temporally, at least, the mind has unified itself upon high levels and attained, as it believes, a genuine consciousness of the divine and veritable world. The depth and richness of its own nature will determine how intense that consciousness shall be. Whatever its scope, however, this new apprehension of reality generally appears to the illuminated self as final and complete, as the true lover is always convinced that he has found in his bride the one rose of the world. So the mystic, in the first glow of his initiation, is sure that his quest is now fulfilled, ignorant as yet of that consummation of love which overpasses the proceedings of the inward eye and ear, he exclaims with entire assurance, "Beati oculi qui exterioribus closi, interioribus autem sunt intenti," and, absorbed in this new blissful act of vision, forgets that it belongs to those who are still in via. He has yet to pass through that night of the senses in which he learns to distinguish the substance of reality from the accidents under which it is perceived, to discover that the heavenly food here given cannot satisfy his hunger for the absolute. His true goal lies far beyond this joyful basking in the sunbeams of the uncreated light. Only the greatest souls learn this lesson and tread the whole of that king's highway which leads man back to his source. For the many that come to Bethlehem, there be few that will go on to Calvary. The rest stay here, in this earthly paradise, these flowery fields, where the liberated self wanders at will, describing to us as well as it can, now this corner, now that, the country of the soul. It is in these descriptions of the joy of illumination, in the outpourings of love and rapture belonging to this state, that we find the most lyrical passages of mystical literature. Here poet, mystic, and musician are on common ground, for it is only by the oblique methods of the artist, by the use of aesthetic suggestions and musical rhythm, that the wonder of that vision can be expressed. When essential goodness, truth, and beauty, light, life, and love, are apprehended by the heart, whether the heart be that of poet, painter, lover, or saint, that apprehension can only be communicated in a living, that is to say, an artistic form. The natural mind is conscious only of succession. The special differentiator of the mystic is the power of apprehending simultaneity. In the peculiarities of the illuminated consciousness, we recognize the effort of the mind to bridge the gap between simultaneity and succession, the characters of creator and creation. Here the successive is called upon to carry the values of the eternal. Here then genius and sanctity kiss one another, and each in that sublime encounter looks for an instant through the other's eyes. Hence it is natural and inevitable that the mystic should here call into play all the resources of artistic expression, the lovely imagery of Julian and Mechtild of Magdeburg, Suso's poetic visions, St. Augustine's fire and light, the heavenly harmonies of St. Francis and Richard Roll. Symbols, too, play a major part, not only in the description, but also in the machinery of illumination. The intuitions of many mystics presenting themselves directly to the surface mind in a symbolic form. We must therefore be prepared for a great variety and fluidity of expression, a constant and not always conscious recourse to symbol and image, in those who try to communicate the secret of this state of consciousness. We must examine and even classify so far as possible a wide variety of experience, some which is recognized by friends and foes alike as purely mystical, some in which the operation of poetic imagination is clearly discernible, some which involve psychic phenomena and other abnormal activities of the mind, refusing to be frightened away from investigation by the strange and apparently irreconcilable character of our material. There are three main types of experience which appear again and again in the history of mysticism, nearly always in connection with illumination rather than any other phase of mystical development. I think that they may fairly be regarded as its main characteristics, though the discussion of them cannot cover all the ground. In few forms of spiritual life is the spontaneity of the individual so clearly seen as here, and in few is the ever-deadly process of classification attended with so many risks. These three characteristics are: 1. A joyous apprehension of the absolute, that which many ascetic writers call the practice of the presence of God. This, however, is not to be confused with that unique consciousness of union with the divine, which is peculiar to a later stage of mystical development. The self, though purified, still realizes itself as a separate entity over against God. It is not immersed in its origin, but contemplates it. This is the betrothal rather than the marriage of the soul. 2. This clarity of vision may also be enjoyed in regard to the phenomenal world. The actual physical perceptions seem to be strangely heightened, so that the self perceives an added significance and reality in all natural things, is often convinced that it knows at last the secret of the world. In Blake's words, the doors of perception are cleansed, so that everything appears to man as it is, infinite. In these two forms of perception, we see the growing consciousness of the mystic stretching in two directions, until it includes in its span both the world of being and the world of becoming. That dual apprehension of reality as transcendent yet immanent, which we found to be one of the distinguishing marks of the mystic type. 3. Along with this twofold extension of consciousness, the energy of the intuitional or transcendental self may be enormously increased. The psychic upheavals of the purgative way have tended to make it central for life, to eliminate from the character all those elements which checked its activity. Now it seizes upon the ordinary channels of expression, and may show itself in such forms as A. auditions, B. dialogues between the surface consciousness and another intelligence which purports to be divine, C. visions, and sometimes D. in automatic writings. In many selves, this automatic activity of those growing but still largely subconscious powers which constitute the new man increases steadily during the whole of the mystic life. Illumination, then, tends to appear mainly under one or all of these three forms. Often all are present, though as a rule one is dominant. The balance of characteristics will be conditioned in each case by the self's psychic makeup, its temperamental leaning towards pure contemplation, lucid vision or automatic expression, emanation or immanence, the metaphysical, artistic or intimate aspects of truth. The possible combinations between these various factors are as innumerable as the possible creations of life itself. in the wonderful rhapsodies of St. Augustine, in St. Bernard's converse with the Word, in Angelo Foligno's apprehensions of deity, in Richard Roll's state of song, when sweetest heavenly melody he took with him dwelling in mind, or in Brother Lawrence's practice of the presence of God, we may see varied expressions of the first type of illuminated consciousness. Jacob Bohme is rightly looked upon as a classic example of the second, which is also found in one of its most attractive forms in St. Francis of Assisi. Suso and St. Teresa, perhaps, may stand for the third, since in them the visionary and auditory phenomena were peculiarly well marked. A further study of each characteristic in order will help us to disentangle the many threads which go to the psychical makeup of these great and complex mystic types. The rest of this chapter will, then, be given to the analysis of the two chief forms of illuminated consciousness, the self's perception of reality in the eternal and temporal worlds. The important subject of voices and visions demands a division to itself. 1. The consciousness of the absolute, or sense of the presence of God. This consciousness, in its various forms and degrees, is perhaps the most constant characteristic of illumination, and makes it, for the mystic soul, a pleasure state of the intensest kind. I do not mean by this that the subject passes months or years in a continuous ecstasy of communion with the divine. Intermittent periods of spiritual fatigue or aridity, renewals of the temperamental conflicts experienced in purgation, the oncoming gloom of the dark night, all these may be, and often are, experienced at intervals during the illuminated life. As flashes of insight, indistinguishable from illumination, constantly break the monotony of the purgative way. But a deep certitude of the personal life omnipresent in the universe has been achieved, and this can never be forgotten, even though it be withdrawn. The spirit stretching towards God declares that it has touched him, and its normal condition henceforth is joyous consciousness of his presence with many privy touchings of sweet spiritual sights and feeling, measured to us as our simpleness may bear it. Where he prefers less definite or more pantheistic language, the mystic's perceptions may take the form of harmony with the infinite, the same divine music transposed to a lower key. This sense of God is not a metaphor. Innumerable declarations prove it to be a consciousness as sharp as that which other men have, or think they have, of colour, heat, or light. It is a well-known, though usually transitory, experience in the religious life, like the homing instinct of birds, a fact which can neither be denied nor explained. How that presence is felt, it may better be known by experience than by any writing, says Hilton, for it is the life and the love, the might and the light, the joy and the rest of a chosen soul. And therefore he that hath soothfastly once felt it, he may not forbear it without pain. He may not undesire it. It is so good in itself and so comfortable. He cometh privily sometimes when thou art least aware of him, but thou shalt well know him or he go. For wonderfully he stirreth, and mightily he turneth thy heart into beholding of his goodness. And doth thine heart melt delectably as wax against the fire into softness of his love. Modern psychologists have struggled hard to discredit this sense of the presence, sometimes attributing it to the psychic mechanism of projection, sometimes to wish fulfillments of a more unpleasant origin. The mystics, however, who discriminate so much more delicately than their critics between true and false transcendental experience, never feel any doubt about its validity. Even when their experience seems inconsistent with their theology, they refuse to be disturbed. Thus St. Teresa writes of her own experience with her usual simplicity and directness. In the beginning it happened to me that I was ignorant of one thing. I did not know that God was in all things, and when he seemed to me to be so near, I thought it impossible. Not to believe that he was present was not in my power, for it seemed to me, as it were, evident that I felt there his very presence. Some unlearned men used to say to me that he was present only by his grace. I could not believe that, because, as I am saying, he seemed to me to be present himself, so I was distressed. A most learned man of the order of the glorious patriarch St. Dominic delivered me from this doubt, for he told me that he was present, and how he communed with us. This was a great comfort to me. Again, an interior peace and the little strength which either pleasures or displeasures have to remove this presence, during the time it lasts, of the three persons, and that without power to doubt of it, continue in such a manner that I clearly seem to experience what St. John says, that he will dwell in the soul, and this not only by grace, but that he will also make her perceive this presence. St. Teresa's strong, immanental bent comes out well in this passage. Such a sense of the divine presence may go side by side with the daily life and normal mental activities of its possessor, who is not necessarily an ecstatic or an abstracted visionary, remote from the work of the world. It is true that the transcendental consciousness has now become, once for all, his centre of interest. Its perceptions and admonitions dominate and light up his daily life. The object of education in the Platonic sense has been achieved. His soul has wheeled round from the perishing world to the contemplation of the real world and the brightest part thereof. But where vocation and circumstances require it, the duties of a busy outward life continue to be fulfilled with steadiness and success, and this without detriment to the soul's contemplation of the real. In many temperaments of the unstable or artistic type, however, this intuitional consciousness of the absolute becomes ungovernable. It constantly breaks through, obtaining forcible possession of the mental field and expressing itself in the psychic phenomena of ecstasy and rapture. In others, less mobile, it wells up into an impassioned apprehension, a flame of love in which the self seems to meet God in the ground of the soul. This is pure contemplation, that state of deep horizon in which the subject seems to be seeing, feeling, and thinking all at once. By this spontaneous exercise of all his powers under the dominion of love, the mystic attains that vision of the heart which, more interior perhaps than the visions of dream or ecstasy, stretches to the full those very faculties which it seems to be holding in suspense, as a top sleeps when it is spinning fast. Ego dormio et cor meum vigilat. This act of contemplation, this glad surrender to an overwhelming consciousness of the presence of God, leaves no sharp image on the mind, only a knowledge that we have been lifted up to a veritable gazing upon that which eye hath not seen. St. Bernard gives in one of his sermons a simple, ingenious, and obviously personal account of such privy touchings, such convincing but elusive contacts of the soul with the absolute. "Now bear with my foolishness for a little," he says, "for I wish to tell you, as I have promised, how such events have taken place in me. It is indeed a matter of no importance, but I put myself forward only that I may be of service to you, and if you derive any benefit, I am consoled for my egotism. If not, I shall but have displayed my foolishness. I confess, then, though I say it in my foolishness, that the Word has visited me, and even very often. But, though he has frequently entered into my soul, I have never at any time been sensible of the precise moment of his coming. I have felt that he was present. I remember that he has been with me. I have sometimes been able even to have a presentiment that he would come, but never to feel his coming nor his departure. From whence he came to enter my soul, or whither he went on quitting it, by what means he has made entrance or departure, I confess that I know not even to this day. According to that which is said, Nescisun de veniatot quo vadat. Nor is this strange, because it is to him that the psalmist has said in another place, Vestigia tua non cognoscentur. It is not by the eyes that he enters, for he is without form or colour that they can discern, nor by the ears, for his coming is without sound, nor by the nostrils, for it is not with the air, but with the mind that he is blended. By what avenue, then, has he entered? Or perhaps the fact may be that he has not entered at all, nor indeed come at all from outside, for not one of these things belongs to outside. Yet it has not come from within me, for it is good, and I know that in me dwelleth no good thing. I have ascended higher than myself, and lo, I have found the Word above me still. My curiosity has led me to descend below myself also, and yet I have found him still at a lower depth. If I have looked without myself, I have found that he is beyond that which is outside of me, and if within, he was at an inner depth still. And thus have I learned the truth of the words I have read. in ipso enem vivimus et movemur et sumus. Such a lifting up, such a condition of consciousness as that which St. Bernard is here trying to describe, seems to snatch the spirit for a moment into a state which it is hard to distinguish from that of true union. This is what the contemplatives call passive or infused contemplation, or sometimes the horizon of union, a brief foretaste of the unitive state, often enjoyed for short periods in the illuminative way, which reinforces their conviction that they have now truly attained the absolute. It is but a foretaste, however, of that attainment, the precocious effort of a soul still in that stage of enlightening which the Theologia Germanica declares to be belonging to such as are growing. This distinction between the temporary experience of union and the achievement of the unitive life is well brought out in a fragment of dialogue between soul and self in Hugh of St. Victor's mystical tract, De Ara Animae. The soul says, "Tell me, what can be this thing of delight that merely by its memory touches and moves me with such sweetness and violence that I am drawn out of myself and carried away, I know not how? I am suddenly renewed, I am changed, I am plunged into an ineffable peace. My mind is full of gladness, all my past wretchedness and pain is forgot. My soul exults, my intellect is illuminated, my heart is afire. My desires have become kindly and gentle. I know not where I am because my love has embraced me. Also, because my love has embraced me, I seem to have become possessed of something, and I know not what it is, but I try to keep it that I may never lose it. My soul strives in gladness that she may not be separated from that which she desires to hold fast forever, as if she had found in it the goal of all her desires. She exults in a sovereign and ineffable manner, seeking nought, desiring nought, but to rest in this. Is this, then, my beloved? Tell me that I may know him, and that if he come again I may entreat him to leave me not, but to stay with me forever." Man says, "It is indeed thy beloved who visits thee, but he comes in an invisible shape. He comes disguised, he comes incomprehensibly. He comes to touch thee, not to be seen of thee, to arouse thee, not to be comprehended of thee. He comes not to give himself wholly, but to be tasted by thee, not to fulfil thy desire, but to lead upwards thy affection. He gives a foretaste of his delights, brings not the plenitude of a perfect satisfaction, and the earnest of thy betrothal consists chiefly in this, that he who shall afterwards give himself to be seen and possessed by thee perpetually, now permits himself to be sometimes tasted, that thou mayest learn how sweet he is. This shall console thee for his absence, and the savour of this gift shall keep thee from all despair." The real distinction between the illuminative and the unitive life is that in illumination, the individuality of the subject, however profound his spiritual consciousness, however close his apparent communion with the infinite, remains separate and intact. His heightened apprehension of reality lights up rather than obliterates the rest of his life, and may even increase his power of dealing adequately with the accidents of normal existence. Thus Brother Lawrence found that his acute sense of reality, his apprehension of the presence of God, and the resulting detachment and consciousness of liberty in regard to mundane things, upheld and assisted him in the most unlikely tasks, as, for instance, when he was sent into Burgundy to buy wine for his convent, which was a very unwelcome task to him, because he had no turn for business, and because he was lame, and could not go about the boat but by rolling himself over the casks. That, however, he gave himself no uneasiness about it, nor about the purchase of the wine, that he said to God it was his business he was about, and that he afterwards found it very well performed. So likewise in his business in the kitchen, to which he had naturally a great aversion. The mind, concentrated upon a higher object of interest, is undistracted by its own anxieties, likes or dislikes, and hence performs the more efficiently the work that is given it to do. Where it does not do so, then the normal make-up or imperfect discipline of the subject, rather than its mystical proclivities, must be blamed. St. Catherine of Genoa found in this divine companionship the power which made her hospital a success. St. Teresa was an administrator of genius and an admirable housewife, and declared that she found her God very easily amongst the pots and pans. Appearances notwithstanding, Mary would probably have been a better cook than Martha, had circumstances required of her this form of activity. In persons of feeble or diffuse intelligence, however, and above all in victims of a self-regarding spirituality, this deep absorption in the sense of divine reality may easily degenerate into monoideism. Then the shady side of illumination, a selfish preoccupation with transcendental joys, the spiritual gluttony condemned by St. John of the Cross, comes out. "I made many mistakes," says Madame Guyon pathetically, "through allowing myself to be too much taken up by my interior joys. I used to sit in a corner and work, but I could hardly do anything, because the strength of this attraction made me let the work fall out of my hands. I spent hours in this way without being able to open my eyes or to know what was happening to me, so simply, so peacefully, so gently that sometimes I said to myself, 'Can heaven itself be more peaceful than I?'" Here we see Madame Guyon basking like a pious tabby cat in the beams of the uncreated light, and already leaning to the extravagances of quietism, with its dangerous double character of passivity and beatitude. The heroic aspect of the mystic vocation is in abeyance. Those mystical impressions which her peculiar psychic makeup permitted her to receive have been treated as a source of personal and placid satisfactions, not as a wellspring, whence new vitality might be drawn for great and self-giving activities. It has been claimed by the early biographers of St. Catherine of Genoa that she passed in the crisis of her conversion directly through the purgative to the unitive life, and never exhibited the characteristics of the luminative way. This has been effectually disproved by Baron von Hugel, though he too is inclined in her case to reject the usual sequence of the mystic states. Yet the description of Catherine's condition after her four great penitential years were ended, as given in Chapter 6 of Vita e Dottrina, is an almost perfect picture of healthy illumination of the inward or immanental type, and makes an effective foil to the passage which I have quoted from Madame Guyon's life. No doubt there were hours in which St. Catherine's experience, as it were, ran ahead, and she felt herself not merely lit up by the indwelling light, but temporarily merged in it. These moments are responsible for such passages as the beautiful fragment in Chapter 5, which does, when taken alone, seem to describe the true unitive state. "Sometimes," she said, "I do not see or feel myself to have either soul, body, heart, will, or taste, or any other thing except pure love." Her normal condition of consciousness, however, was clearly not yet that which Julian of Norwich calls being one with bliss, but rather an intense and continuous communion with an objective reality, which was clearly realized as distinct from herself. "After the aforesaid 4 years," says the next chapter of the Vita, "there was given unto her purified mind, free and filled with God, insomuch that no other thing could enter into it. Thus, when she heard sermons or mass, so much was she absorbed in her interior feelings, that she neither heard nor saw that which was said or done without. But within, in the sweet divine light, she saw and heard other things, being wholly absorbed by that interior light, and it was not in her power to act otherwise." St. Catherine, then, is still a spectator of the Absolute, does not feel herself to be one with it. And it is a marvellous thing that with so great an interior recollection, the Lord never permitted her to go beyond control. But when she was needed, she always came to herself, so that she was able to reply to that which was asked of her. And the Lord guided her, that none could complain of her. And she had her mind so filled by love divine, that conversation became hard to her. And by this continuous taste and sense of God, several times she was so greatly transported that she was forced to hide herself, that she might not be seen. It is clear, however, that Catherine herself was aware of the transitory and imperfect nature of this intensely joyous state. Her growing transcendental self, unsatisfied with the sunshine of the illuminative way, the enjoyment of the riches of God, already aspired to union with the divine. With her, as with all truly heroic souls, it was love for love, not love for joy. She cried to God because he gave her so many consolations.
Non voglio quello che esce da te, ma so voglio te, o dolce amore.
Non voglio quello che esce da te. When the growing soul has reached this level of desire, the illuminative way is nearly at an end. It has seen the goal, that country which is no mere vision, but a home, and is set upon the forward march. So Rabia, the Moslem saint, O my God, my concern and my desire in this world is that I should remember thee above all the things of this world, and in the next that out of all who are in that world I should meet with thee alone. So Gertrude Moore, no knowledge which we can here have of thee can satisfy my soul-seeking and longing without ceasing after thee. Alas, my Lord God, what is all thou canst give to a loving soul which sigheth and panteth after thee alone, and esteemeth all things as dung, that she may gain thee? What is all I say whilst thou givest not thyself, who art that one thing which is only necessary, and which alone can satisfy our souls? Was it any comfort to St. Mary Magdalene, when she sought thee, to find two angels which presented themselves instead of thee? Verily I cannot think it was any joy unto her, for that soul that hath set her whole love and desire on thee can never find any true satisfaction, but only in thee. What is the nature of this mysterious mystic illumination? Apart from the certitude it impacts, what is the form which it most usually assumes in the consciousness of the self? The illuminative seem to assure us that its apparently symbolic name is really descriptive, that they do experience a kind of radiance, a flooding of the personality with new light. A new sun rises above the horizon and transfigures their twilight world. Over and over again they return to light imagery in this connection. Frequently, as in their first conversion, they report an actual and overpowering consciousness of radiant light, ineffable in its splendour, as an accompaniment of their inward adjustment.
Soprone lingua amore, bonda senza figura, lume fuora di misura splenda nel mio cuore, sang Jacopone da Todi.
Light rare, untellable, said Whitman. The flowing light of the Godhead, said Mechtild of Magdeburg, trying to describe what it was that made the difference between her universe and that of normal men.
Lux vixens dicit, said St. Hildegard of her revelations, which she described as appearing in a special light, more brilliant than the brightness round the sun.
It is an infused brightness, says St. Teresa, a light which knows no night, but rather, as it is always light, nothing ever disturbs it.
Desubito parve giorno a giorno essere aggiunto, exclaims Dante, initiated into the atmosphere of heaven. Lume lassù is his constant declaration. Ciò ch'io dico è un semplice lume, his last word, in the effort to describe the soul's apprehension of the being of God.
It really seems as though the mystic's attainment of new levels of consciousness did bring with it the power of perceiving a splendour always there, but beyond the narrow range of our poor sight, to which it is only a luminous darkness at the best. In eternal nature or the kingdom of heaven, said Law, materiality stands in life and light. The cumulative testimony on this point is such as would be held to prove in any other department of knowledge that there is indeed an actual light, lighting the very light and awaiting the recognition of men.
End of first half of part 2, chapter 4.